Our next speaker is Michael Ahern. Am I saying that right?
That's right.
All right. He has over 25 years of experience in development, construction, operation, and management of industrial and energy systems, managing the development, construction, and startup of over $1 billion of new systems. Since joining the Evergreen team, he's led the development of energy systems throughout the U.S. and Canada. Welcome, Michael.
Good afternoon. This will be a little bit of a departure from the discussions, I think, that you've been having all day. Going to enter into the energy industry probably a little more than you expected that you're going to. I'll start out right away. I'm not a geologist. I'm not a groundwater specialist. Any technical questions that get asked, I'm going to point at somebody else in the room and say, you have to answer this because I can't. But that being said, do want to talk about the energy industry a little bit and how our industry is changing and how your industry is starting to have a greater and greater impact on solutions that we can bring to our customers and ultimately heat and cool buildings like the one that you're in today. Evergreen Energy, we're an operator and manager of district energy systems. We develop, install, operate, and manage systems that heat and cool buildings. The most noteworthy locally here would be District Energy St. Paul, if any of you are familiar with the heating and cooling plant in downtown right next to the Science Museum. That's our system. We operate and manage it. We burn biomass to generate roughly 25 megawatts of electricity we put out to the grid, and we heat and cool roughly 85% of downtown. And then we also operate and manage several other systems in the upper Midwest, and we work with communities and campuses across the U.S. up into Canada, where we will help them develop an energy program that works for them, that achieves the goals that they've established. Carrie earlier had mentioned the Carleton geothermal project. That's one where we had helped Carleton work through the integration of the geothermal field with their energy system to meet the needs of their buildings. And so that's the expertise that we bring to the table and the types of projects that we are involved in. We'll be talking specifically about the Ford site today, but we're currently working on the development of energy systems at the Hillcrest site on Eastern St. Paul, the Rice Creek Common site up in Arden Hills, Ford, the Towerside District just to the east side of U of M campus. And in every one of those circumstances, we're leveraging groundwater at some level to deliver energy solutions to the prospective buildings on those campuses. So what we're seeing in our industry right now is quite a change and quite a changing dynamic. You may see some articles in the papers and online talking about how electric utilities are really facing a changing dynamic, particularly with the integration of renewables and a tipping point where renewables are starting to really disrupt what has been business as usual for those utilities over the last 30 to 40 years. Same thing's happening for us in the thermal utility delivery industry. There's emerging technologies that allow individual buildings, campuses to develop their own energy solutions. There is a strong push for sustainability, and sustainability means decarbonization. It means elimination of water use, at least the elimination of potable water use for non-potable purposes. And then, of course, everybody is always looking for lower-cost energy alternatives to what they have today. And so we have all of those dynamics, and when we go into a planning for a particular campus or community, if you have a site, for instance, like the Ford site in St. Paul, where it's going to go through massive redevelopment, the planners are asking, how can we serve the energy needs of that campus in a way that localizes the energy delivery, that decarbonizes it, and that conserves the use of water on that campus? So one of the solutions that has been emerging in the states, and I want to emphasize emerging in the states because it's been in practice and in play in Northern Europe for over 25 years, is aquifer thermal energy storage. And boiled down quite simply, it's you can utilize the aquifers as batteries. You can heat or store heat in the aquifer in the summer, taking the heat out of buildings and storing it in the aquifer in the summer. And then you take that heat out of the aquifer in the winter for purposes of heating those buildings. That's the fundamental of it. Clearly, it needs to get more technical than that. But that is one solution that is emerging here in North America, and we're starting to identify it as a very viable solution on a number of the campuses that we're working with. It functions a lot like a traditional geothermal system, except a significantly lower level of wells that need to be implemented on the site to achieve that. And it's, of course, the detailed dynamics of it are a little bit different. From a building side, it very much looks and feels like a traditional geothermal field. But it's a mechanism that can be used to serve heat and cool a very large campus, and one that can be done when you don't have significant amount of green space to be able to have a vast well field. One of the dynamics that feeds into it is you need to have very low groundwater velocity. So we're looking for groundwater velocity of less than around a foot per day within the aquifer, because you don't want to be storing that heat in the ground and then have it leave your campus. So it's a very important dynamic. That's something in the upper Midwest, and particularly in Minnesota here, we have a number of areas where that is the case. And so we have that opportunity to implement that technology within a number of these campuses. Again, visually looks, this is a visual, and this is actually for a system in Sweden, in Stockholm, Sweden, that serves the Arlanda Airport, where they utilize this aquifer thermal energy storage. But again, simply put, you have heating wells on one side of your campus and you have cooling wells on the other side of your campus. In the summer, you're pumping from the cooling wells, you're pulling the heat out of the buildings and injecting the warmer water into the other side of the campus. And in the winter, you reverse the flow. You're pulling the groundwater out of the heating wells, extracting the heat from the groundwater and injecting it back over to the other side. It's a balanced flow. We're never taking that groundwater anywhere. So as much as we pull out, we inject back in. And we aren't distributing the groundwater into individual buildings. There's a single interface point where the energy is exchanged so that we can minimize the amount of transfer of that groundwater and minimize the touch of the groundwater. It's, you know, you have heat exchangers that exchange the energy between a freshwater loop that will then go out into the individual buildings and heat for heat and cooling purposes. Of course, from a regulatory perspective, we want to minimize what we're doing with that groundwater itself. And again, we want that balance between what we inject and what we take out. So it's a high level on the technology itself. And actually, I'll pause at this moment to see if there's specific questions before I jump into the Ford site and talk about the applicability there, if anybody has any questions about the technology itself. Great. I must have just done a perfect. Oh, no, not that perfect. And again, now remember, it can't be too technical.
I'm going to use a big word, dipole. So do you ever do a situation where you're injecting your hot water, and by the time it gets to the other well, that it is warm, and you just keep it going the same direction, or do you always flip the direction?
You have to flip the direction.
Okay.
So what we're talking about from a temperature differential perspective is around 10 to 15 degrees F that we will have in the changing temperature from the heated wells to the cooling wells. I think right now we're modeling the Ford site, the one we'll talk about in detail here, at 15 F. But no, you're always, you know, you've got the warmer side and the cooler side. And to the extent that you would have a significant deviation in that temperature, then your economics are going to be more challenged. You'd also have trending on that well, on that aquifer, that over time is going to negatively impact your ability to deliver to customers how modeled. And I will say we've got plenty of models and they're exactly wrong. So, but they are useful.
For a airport like this, what kind of total flow rates do you need?
So I can't answer that for this. I will be able to, I will get to that on the Ford site. I'm sorry, I just don't know the details of the Stockholm site. So we'll jump in. We can come back to any technology questions that you may have specifically as I get through the Ford site. So many of you, I'm sure, in this room have tracked the Ford site redevelopment. It certainly has been a political issue from the perspective of what exactly gets developed there. Those challenges have started to wane, and we're actually getting more and more into actual practical implementation. It's roughly 135-acre site. There is expected to be around 5 million square feet of multifamily residential, mixed use, some commercial retail, some single-family homes. The city has identified some very stringent goals that they want to see in play at the Ford site, particularly around decarbonization, around water use. They certainly have some density goals and some other groundwater and stormwater management goals that they've established for the site. And the planning in place right now has really started to feed and identify a nice path for the city to achieve those goals. There's been very good coordinated discussions between the city, Ryan Companies, who is the local developer developing the site, and then Ford Land, who had been responsible for cleaning up the previously contaminated site and positioning it for this redevelopment that is now going to occur. A couple of nice images, the one of when the trucks were still being manufactured, and of course the bottom image is one version of what Ryan Companies intends to build there. So our proposed system, to your question, for the roughly 5 million square feet, we're looking at needing around 5,000 GPM. We're intending to, our wells right now as designed, we figure we're going to have 6 to 7 heating wells, 6 to 7 cooling wells, one on obviously one side of the site and the heating on one side and the cooling on the other. So pumping, around that 5,000 GPM in order to meet that load. It's very important, and we've talked through this with a number of folks, but it's very important to emphasize we are not distributing the groundwater to all of the buildings. We'll have a fairly direct route between the heating wells and the cooling wells, and then somewhere along that line we'll have a pumping house and energy transfer stations so that we'll have a freshwater loop, a closed loop system that will distribute that energy, that heating and that cooling to the individual buildings for purposes of serving their needs, their thermal energy needs. Right now what we're focusing on is the multifamily residential, which is the apartment buildings over on the eastern side of the site, as well as then the commercial and retail, which are on the northern side of the site. Some second and third versions of our modeling, we are pulling in the row houses and then the single family homes. Our hope and goal, and when I say our, that's of the city and Ryan Companies, as well as ourselves as the developer of the energy system. Our goal is that the beneficial economics of the multifamily residential are going to allow us to connect the single family homes as well. Single family homes get a little more challenged financially because there's not as much energy usage and you're installing more infrastructure to serve a lower energy load. But because of the density of the site and because of there's roughly 3,800 multifamily residential units within this very tight area, we have a pretty high level of confidence that we're going to be able to serve the entire campus with this carbon-free energy source. On day one, a term that you're hearing or you will be reading more as a non-energy industry person is strategic electrification. As Xcel Energy's grid continues to decarbonize, as they integrate more wind and solar and reduce their overall carbon profile, the energy industry is pushing toward the elimination of combustion of natural gas for purposes of heating buildings, and rather leveraging that decarbonized electric grid for purposes of heating those individual buildings. Now, in this circumstance, we're heating and cooling. As the Xcel grid continues to decarbonize, the carbon footprint of the Ford site using this technology will continue to reduce. As we look at other non-carbon strategies to integrate with this program, we can then continue to find ways to drive down the carbon footprint of the site. And I'll touch on a couple of those here in a moment. So when I talk about setting the foundation for net net zero carbon development. On day one, this site won't be net zero carbon, but we have the infrastructure in place to be able to achieve it as other market dynamics enable that to happen, some of which will be inside of our control, some of which are as it relates to Xcel's good work that they're doing. So, of course, first question the developer asks us, we've been working on this program with the city for roughly 5 years now, and just recently begun working with Ryan Companies as they've taken over, or as they've secured their arrangement with Ford Land. Of course, the first question is, what's it going to cost? You know, what's the financial impact to Ford? And as an operator and manager of energy systems, we can't, you know, we're not a traditional consultant. We just can't come in and say, here's what you should do, and then walk away and let them figure out the financial ramifications. We're coming in and saying, we've got a business model that has to work, and that can be financed out in the private markets that we can stand behind, and leveraging our relationships to do that. So that's always the goal when we lay out one of these plans, is it has to be at a minimum net zero. But it really, there's a three-layered analysis on the financial side, because it has to be a net zero cost for the developers. They're also, then we have to look at the building owners, because the developers aren't always the building owners. We have to look at the building owners' costs over a 30-year life cycle. And then we have to look at the tenants. As you've heard about the Ford site already, 3,800 units, multifamily residential, most of them are not going to be owners of those buildings. So the tenants can't have a higher energy cost, the building owners can't have higher energy-related costs, and the developers can't be asked to invest any more money into the site than what they're planning through their traditional development plan. So that's a mark we have to hit, because of the fact that the energy is, for all intents and purposes, free. This is a fantastic opportunity for us to achieve that. We invest in a little more upfront infrastructure to be able to leverage this technology, but then over a 30-year life cycle, it shows a financially beneficial payback for everybody involved. And we're not asking any of those three parties to make that investment. We go out and debt finance that infrastructure based upon long-term energy service agreements that get put in place with the building owners. Of course, for the building owners, there's other benefits beyond the financial component. They have reduced maintenance. They have less moving parts inside their buildings. They don't have to worry about boilers, cooling towers, magic packs, any unitary heating solutions. It's a much more simplified delivery of energy inside the individual buildings. Reduces labor costs. Reduces the amount of footprint that they need for their energy systems, which actually allows them to have more rental space for the given acreage that they have in their plots. And then again, ultimately, they're able to market their sites as lower energy costs for their tenants, as well as a decarbonized energy system compared to other developments. Day one environmental benefits of this system. With Xcel's current grid, we're looking at a reduction of roughly 37% of the carbon that would otherwise be emitted on that site. So roughly 4,000 tons of CO2. And as you see then, as Xcel achieves their decarbonization goals that they've established to get to 2030, almost a 40% reduction in their carbon profile, now all of a sudden we're at a 60% reduction in carbon. But that's not enough. That's not where the city wants to take this site. So there's other broader site initiatives that can not only help the county or the city achieve their goals, but also their broader goals for the site, but also enable certain buildings to achieve net zero carbon on day one. So we're working with the developer to identify opportunities for localized solar PV, where then behind the meter, those individual buildings can generate their own electricity, carbon-free electricity, leverage that electricity for their individual building, and now they've got renewable carbon-free electricity that serves their building's needs and also integrates with our thermal system, so that it could be carbon-free heating and cooling immediately for those individual buildings. We're working with Xcel to identify one of the goals for the site is the city would like to see the Ford site become a microgrid. And you've got the hydro dam right adjacent to that site. Is there an opportunity to have to essentially, in the event of some type of grid disruption, you disconnect the Ford site from the grid, but keep it connected to the hydro dam so that you could keep that site up with a carbon-free energy source that also then continues to integrate with our thermal energy delivery program. And then, of course, on the early planning side, we're working with the University of Minnesota Center for Sustainable Building Research to lay out enhanced building design strategies, you know, making sure that these buildings aren't using any more energy than they have to, making sure that you've got smart metering in the buildings, ongoing commissioning of the buildings so that they're performing the way they were designed to perform. And then as battery storage technology emerges, that becomes one more component of how these individual buildings can be leveraging as much of the solar and carbon-free energy that they have available to, or electricity that they'll have access to for purposes of not only their plug loads, but of course, integration with our thermal energy system. So where is it today? There may even be specific people that we've been talking to within the PCA and Department of Health and DNR about this. We've kind of worked through what needs to happen from a permitting perspective when we're ready to come with the formal asks. Right now, where we're at is we've been engaged with Ryan Companies for about 4 months, taking their specific site development plan and applying our modeling to what they have specifically. Again, to Blythe's previous discussion, we had all kinds of models over the last few years, and they were all wrong because we were just guessing as to what the developer was going to do. We now know what Ryan is actually going to build on the site. We've updated our models. They're still perfectly wrong, but they at least give us a little bit better indication of how things look. And so now we have to do some validation on some of our assumptions, specifically around the velocity of the groundwater. We're looking at integration with either the Jordan Aquifer or the Prairie du Chien. Those are the two that seem to have the best dynamics for us to serve this system. It may even be that we're interfacing with both. But what we need to do now, and we're just trying to get through the final approvals with Ford Land to allow our test wells to be drilled on the site. We're hopeful that actually happens here. The approvals come through. We get the necessary permits, and we're doing some test well drilling in December, which will allow us to upgrade our design or advance our design, upgrade our modeling, and begin the more formal permitting process. We've had early conversations with the Department of Health, laid out the types of permits we need for this aquifer thermal energy storage system, and then, of course, continued consultation with DNR and PCA at the same time. We also then need to continue on the business side of things. And so we're literally meeting again tomorrow and have been meeting weekly to work through what our energy service agreements look like, how our energy rates are going to be structured, how the business model looks both for building owners and tenants, as well as, of course, the initial developers of the site, to make sure it doesn't negatively impact anybody's overall pro forma. And then, of course, with our financing partners so that we can bring the money in to implement the system. So with that, I guess the very last bullet I missed that is extremely important is outreach and engagement. And this spans across every industry. As we all are a little more technically inclined, we like to talk at our technical level, but the general public wants to know about these types of programs. They need to know about these types of programs so that they can become champions of them and so that you can stop any false rumors about what's happening with the energy system. And so that's a extremely important component of the development and implementation of this energy system, as well as any energy system we're working on, is making sure the general public, local schools, and then, of course, the agencies and the local government are understanding of what you're trying to do and can have their questions answered properly. I'll open for questions then at this point. So I think what you're asking is the size of the wells for...
At 8,000 GPM for 4 or 5 months of injection, did you estimate the size of that injected area?
Our technical specialist has that information. I do not know the size of that. It's the first time I've heard the term bubble, so I will go back and ask, and I'm sure he'll be impressed when I ask him that question. I'm sorry. I
question. All right. I'm over here. Have you had to consider, and you know, I'm not sure what depth you're pumping from or planning to pump from, and I know it's a zero. What you pump out, you're pumping back in, but have you had to consider any potential impacts thermally to the adjacent, I believe it's the Mississippi River, and what that could do ecologically to the river? I mean, have you had to work that through in your modeling?
That is part of the discussion. The you know, in a given year, it's projected to be a net neutral thermal or a temperature differential. Will, you know, the intention is to balance the system so we're never trending positive or trending negative on the from a temperature perspective within the aquifers. So it's more of a, you know, 6 month on, 6 month off perspective. And we're also managing our temperature differential in the sense that we're 10 to 15 degrees F of a differential. So again, the detailed modeling for that, I personally haven't done, but I know that's part of the conversation. Yes, sir.
We've got one back here.
Oh, I don't know if I missed this, but do you have any idea when they're planning on like starting construction and when the completion date is estimated to be?
So I'm not speaking for Ryan Companies. I'll just share with you what I've heard from them, and their plan changes daily as they deal with different market conditions. Their goal is to break ground later next fall or early 2020. That's the last I've heard them publicly state. But again, I'm not speaking for Ryan Companies.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
So you haven't put any test wells in, I know.
But no, we're intending in this next month.
But what are you expecting the flow rates to be across the site in those aquifers?
We are expecting it to be less than a foot per day.
And then what problems do you typically have with reinjection of 5,000 gallons a minute in a half dozen wells? Technical problems and getting the water to actually reinject.
One more question. I'm sorry that I can't specifically answer.
Do you have any examples of ATS systems that have been installed in Minnesota in the past or in areas with similar geology to the Ford plant?
So there's quite a few examples of similar geology, but not in the States. It's all Northern Europe. So it's similar, but different, of course. There aren't examples of this technology being implemented in the States. This is an emerging technology here, emerging in the sense of a number of different areas where it's being planned. And of course, learnings will be coming from those.
I have a completely off-topic question.
Sure.
Is the Ford Dam there has a power plant in it. Is that power plant still functional, and can I buy it?
So it is functional. Brookfield is the owner of the plant. They paid a lot for it, so I hope you have your checkbook. But that is the hydro dam that I was discussing that currently puts that hydroelectricity out to the grid, and that's part of what we all use for lighting. But there are conversations about possibly interconnecting it specifically with the Ford site. So you could have an exclusive microgrid in the event of some type of grid disruption.
One more question.
So in the late 1980s, there was an aquifer thermal energy storage project right here on the St. Paul campus. That was an investigation to see how it would work. One of the big problems they ran into was just precipitation of calcite, putting in hot water into the aquifer. Everything just basically locked up. Is this something that you guys are looking at, just sort of the chemical aspects of this?
Yes, and if I recall correctly, the example here on this campus is the temperatures that were being leveraged at that time were more significant. It was high temperature. It was over 100 degrees F that was getting injected. We're talking about ranging from 65 to 70 F on the high side to 50 or 45 F on the low side. So much more in like a traditional geothermal system than the high temperatures that were done here.
I think with that, Michael, we'll wrap it up. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. And we have one more speaker before the break.